session number 18528, Reel 1.
David Kanzler, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Hackney, London, in 1925.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hackney?
No, I didn't. My schooling was at Shoreham Grammar and Chesterfield College.
Where's Shoreham Grammar?
Shoreham Grammar is in Shoreham. Shoreham by sea, in actual fact. Prior to that, in London, I was educated at Chester College, which was a preparatory college to Harrow.
So
I moved from London to during the war years.
So how old were you when you finished your schooling?
I must have been about 15, I suppose. About 15. We were down at West Worthing, so I used to travel from there to Shoreham. And eventually, we came back to London. And my father got me into a lot of jobs here and there. But I decided I had enough, and so I volunteered to go into the army when I was 17.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war?
Yes, I did.
Under what circumstances?
We were living at a place called West Worthing, and the actual road was Georgia Fifth Avenue.
And what was your reaction, if any, to the news?
I was tempered with a little excitement, I suppose, being young.
No sense of dread?
No, I can't say that there was, I have to be honest with you. No.
Did the war affect you before you went into the army in any way?
No, notwithstanding the fact that we came back to London, unfortunately, and we landed right in the middle of the beginning of the air raids on London.
What was your address when the Blitz was going on?
Bromsby Park, Wilson Green. Bromsby Park. Well, not far from Kilburn, in that direction. Between Kilburn and Easton, actually.
Did many bombs fall in that area?
Yes, they did. They did.
Can you describe what the bombing was like in Wilson Green?
In the immediate locality, it appeared to be substantial. They dropped landmines and DA bombs, etc. But further afield, if we're talking about Kensal Rise, they dropped it on gasworks and all sorts of places. And of course, the fire in London itself, you could see from where we were.
So this was 1940 to 43?
And in fact, the house next door was hit by incendiary bombs.
How frightening was the bombing, as far as
it
you
It could be quite frightening, because it was accompanied by this whistling noise as the bombs came down.
Did you use shelters?
Yeah, in the house, actually, under the billiard table. Subsequently, my father had a shelter built in the garden, underground shelter, which, ironically enough, I think we only used once.
How do you think public morale in Willesden Green stood up to the Blitz?
Very well indeed. It was a sort of, we can take it sort of business.
Did you ever come across anybody whose nerve cracked?
Not personally, I didn't know, but I gather the house behind us, ironically enough, had refugees and had a direct hit.
Refugees from Germany?
Ironically.
Did you know them?
No, they were under the aegis of a convent.
What street was that in?
Behind us, in the main road, if you like, into Kilburn, I suppose. I can't remember.
What was the attitude towards the German air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
They were difficult to determine, because one never had an occasion to talk to people in that respect. But I think people in general were very indifferent. To that extent, they'd taken so much, I suppose, and to them it was just another day. I mean, they knew they obviously at war with Germany and all the rest of it, but I think people were too, what's the word, introvert perhaps, in as much that they didn't go around screaming and shouting abuse about the Germans.
Did you ever listen to Lord Haw Haw?
Once only I did. I was rather amused, actually, by his accent.
What about listening to Churchill?
Churchill, yes, we did listen to him. We were quite impressed by his oratory.
Do you remember any specific streets and buildings that were hit in your area?
Well, the one in Bromsley Park, which is the main thoroughfare, residential-wise, of course. There were a number of houses hit there, of course. And in Willesden Green itself, in fact, near the station, a landmine was dropped and did quite a considerable amount of damage.
Now, can you tell me about joining up yourself in 43?
Yes, I can. I don't quite know what possessed me, but I thought I had enough, and I took a bus to Acton, where the recruiting office was.
Did you have a job at the time?
No, I don't think I did at the time. I don't think so. I was with my parents, of course.
What happened at the recruiting office?
Oh, I just went in there, and usual recruiting people were there. Actually, it was quite afternoon. It was an Acton High Street. Acton Lane was the actual location. TA Centre. They sort of commandeered. And I went in there and I saw the recruiting sergeant, told him to join up. And of course, he said, OK. Usual preliminary questions about if you were fit and all the rest of it. Antecedents. And he said, by the way, how old are you? He said, have you got your birth certificate? Oh, God, I said, I've forgotten it. Because he knew I hadn't. I mean, they all came out with that story. He said, all right, then, well, how old are you? I said, I'm 70, well, nearly 18. All right. That was it. Took the shilling, signed on, attested, and a few weeks later I was called up.
What happened then?
I went to Worley Barracks in Brentford, is it? Essex. So the general corps, they called it, army corps, where people join initially for initial training prior to posting to regiments. And one particular character I remember extremely well was the Chief of Staff General Sir Alan Brooke, who was actually visiting the location at the time I arrived.
What was your basic training like?
Well, I suppose being unused to that sort of thing, rigorous, hard, but enjoyable.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
Very well. In fact, I was my company commander was, if you believe this, a newspaper man, vendor. I say vendor, but he was a captain, so he was a real cockney.
So you did the basic training at Worley Barracks?
Yes, indeed. It's all actually in that red book.
And after the basic training?
I then went to the Royal, I think it was the Royal Fusiliers. Yes, it was the Royal Fusiliers. From there I went to the Isle of Wight, I did training there, we got involved with operations. I think, can I just...
just go from memory.
From there, anyway, from there, the battalion went to the Isle of Wight, we got involved with pre-D-Day training with Montgomery's forces up at West Hartlepool, etc., etc. It was, and from there I was transferred from the Royal Fusiliers to the Bedford and Hertfordshire Regiment, which was singled out as the combined forces for D-Day.
Which battalion of the Beds and
Hertfordshire? I think it was the 2nd Battalion. They had a very short life, I have to say. They were part of the 3rd Division, which landed at Armagh.
And what was the pre-D-Day training like for you?
Well, again, it's a big smile to your face, I'm sure. I was attached to a padre as a batman. So you can see. In terms of what the boys actually did, it wasn't relative at all. It was looking after the padre, which was rather funny. But nevertheless, I did get involved, of course, on manoeuvres, as he had to. But all in all, it was quite a rigorous situation while it lasted. And then we went to outside Windsor, in assembly areas.
What was the padre like to work for?
Nice chap. Although I have to tell you in haste, of different religious persuasion. All right, Alec.
What was his religion?
Church of England.
And what's yours?
Of Jewish. Not that there was any sort of obvious demarcation.
I should have asked you about your surname. Is it a German surname?
It's Austrian.
Did that ever cause you any problems
None
in the army?
Not at all.
And you said that you were in a secure area before D-Day.
Yes, indeed I was. Outside Windsor.
What happened there?
Well, the battalions were just sort of heaved to, if you like. Weren't allowed out. The usual, really sort of constrictions in the air. No mail, mail was limited. You weren't allowed out in, under any circumstances. Entertainment was provided by Enfer and people like that. But and the guards were outside to stop people from going out. And we were there for a while, and subsequently we moved to West India Docks. And incidentally, I have to tell you that on one of the videos I've got upstairs, there is a picture of me, would you believe, actually walking up the gangplank of this ship. How on earth that happened? But we actually embarked at West London Docks. I suppose West India Docks, I should say. On the ship called the SS Neuralia, which was a former Indian troop ship.
Was this the whole battalion?
Yes, well, yes, it would be the whole battalion, because the battalion went ashore in that respect. In addition to that, there were commandos on board and engineers. There were about 2,000 troops on board.
Did the local population give you any kind of service?
Yes, they did, as we marched down to the docks. They were handing out chocolates and tea and all this, you know. It was quite an emotional sort of business, you know. It was as if the First World War being repeated again. You know, the chaps were singing on, you know.
Had D-Day started by now?
No. We were then destined for the Isle of Wight, which was the area for assembly for all the ships.
What happened on the voyage?
It was very, I mean, we had boat drill of sort. I have to tell you that we were on the sixth deck down. So, I mean, it was quite claustrophobic, you can imagine. We weren't allowed up during the course. I mean, we were in harbour, well, in the area of the Isle of Wight, for about 3 or 4 days before the Armada moved off. You know, and the seas were pretty rough then, actually. We were wondering, you know. I've written something here about my adventures of disembarking from that ship.
Tell me about them now, please. No, don't read it out, just go from memory.
Well, just, we were on the sixth deck, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, we were getting ready to have breakfast, if you can call it that. I referred to it somewhat facetiously as the Last Supper. And we eventually went up on deck, and we were paraded in sections, because the craft that were taking us off, the LCIs, they were only small ones, could only take a couple of sections at a time, or platoon, I think, to be exact. And so we were all lined up, and you imagine, we were on deck prior to the actual point of disembarkation, so we could see the smoke screens from Cape Renez along the channel. There were American destroyers on the port bow, laying thick smoke screens. And, and of course you could see the aircraft as well. And then as we swung to the starboard, if you like, to face port side on to the landing area, you could hear and see silhouettes of the Nelson and other battleships firing broadsides at the Calais and places like that too, and the fortifications in general along that area. So anyway, we eventually, by platoons, got ready to disembark, which was quite, I have to tell you, was quite a precarious situation for me. I'm not terribly good at heights. And so we had to, and the method of disembarkation was the, not rope ladders, they were cargo nets. They were slung over the side, and you had to put your foot over the bath rail and find a foothold and then proceed to descend. Your rifle was thrown to a matter at the bottom of the landing craft, because otherwise you had problems. And of course, the crucial moment was you had to wait until the craft came up because of the swell in order to jump as near as possible to the landing craft, into it. Which, of course, this was heralded by the usual shout, jump sort of business. And you had to let go and literally drop free fall into the arms of a Mackler. Which wasn't particularly funny. I have a sort of a funny story about that. But
tell me it, please.
Well, I describe my descent. I must...
No, don't go from the paper, just go from memory.
Well, I can remember it all. I remember I thought that I couldn't very well pray because I was in that difficult position with both hands engaged as I wanted to. And I felt, and on arrival, a character who actually gripped me as we landed reminded me of a biblical character who's well known since he had a beard and everything else. And I thought, well, perhaps I've arrived in heaven or hell at last all this. But as I say, it was, I have to say, in that particular moment, more frightening, if you like, than the prospects of what faceless women and men on the beach. So we got into the ship. It was manned by two sailors, a coxswain and a crewman. Only two. And it had a pep, pep, pop, pop engine. And we then proceeded ashore. So far. And she stopped. And a rope was, I don't know how they did it, but a rope was slung from the craft to the beach.
Were you under fire?
We, in generally speaking, we were, because the Germans had by this time realised what was going on and were firing, excuse me, artillery and small arms fire. But the biggest danger, of course, I have to say, was the mines, which had been attached to the obstacles in the... in the shoreline. They were their biggest problem.
And this was Sod Beach, was it?
Gold.
Which division did you belong to?
The third. It was attached, it was the left flank guarding the bridgehead. And we were part of the third division.
I think that must have been Sod Beach, I think.
Well, they refer to it in the book as Gold Beach. It may be the sector was gold.
It would be on record anyway.
Because I did in fact ask my MP to get some facts from the War Office about the battalion's situation on D-Day for record purposes. And it said that we'd landed on Gold Beach. In fact, one or two of the books I've got here refer specifically to Gold Beach. Anyway, we landed on the beach, but during the course of that landing, there was all sorts of various mishaps. One of them being that when you put your equipment on, you were told to put it on over your life belt, not under it. So in consequence, if, for example, you happen to fall or something, by unbuckling your belt, the force of water will fall. And so you were left with your life belt, your life jacket. Unfortunately, some people, I don't know why, didn't do that. So when they did have this occasion to, they never came up. They couldn't, could they, with 60 odd pounds on their back?
Did you see that happen?
Twice. Nothing you could do. Because you were holding your rifle in one hand, and holding onto a rope which had been slung across from the landing craft to the beach as a way of getting across. I don't know who conceived that idea, but you're up to, I would say, well over the waistline. So it wasn't a dry landing, as had been promised. It was not.
Was the landing a frightening experience for you?
No, and the reason being, I think you were so obsessed with the ambience that was going on, you didn't stop to reason as to why you should be frightened or not. I mean, you could see all sorts of things happening on either side of you, you know. Well, I suppose where you were self-preservation, you just get there off the roster, because as long as you were in that particular predicament, you were a sitting duck. And so you had to get ashore quick.
Was your role still as the Padre's Batman?
No. That was dispensed with when we changed from the Royal Fusiliers into the Beds and Hearts. I was an infanteer.
And which company did you belong to?
Good point there. I think, again, so long ago, I'm pretty sure it was B Company.
Do you remember the platoon?
Well, I remember some characters, and one in particular, the platoon commander who was a sergeant. Why I remember him was because he was a very attractive chap, I have to say, in the nicest possible way. He had blonde hair. He was really, in fact, he looked more like an Aryan rather than an Englishman. And he subsequently got killed.
And what was to be your role on landing?
To clear the beaches of any snipers or anybody who had been left behind who were holding out. We were clearing beaches. The subsequent task immediately after that was to clear the beaches of debris, corpses, and make it a clear area for oncoming reinforcements.
Was there any enemy to be cleared from the beaches,
yes, there was,
as far as you were concerned?
Yes, there was. One company under the command of an officer who was, I can't think of his name, I know him, to look at him, I know him. They got stuck, as it were, in a blockhouse situation. See, the Germans stayed in some of these blockhouses until the main force had gone past. So that was our job to scout them out. So there was a firefight.
Were you personally involved in
that? Not in that particular situation, no.
Was there much in the way of debris and so on to be cleared?
Oh, yes. There was debris. There was bodies. Burnt out tanks. Huh? And the occasional fountain of water, the shells the Germans were firing, dropped into the drink.
Any specific memories that happened to you from that day once you landed?
I think there must have been several, but one in particular, I suppose, is when we discovered to our horror that we'd been sleeping on anti-tank lines. And that was discovered by mere accident. So we had to clear them ourselves.
That was on D-Day night, was it?
No, D plus one. We had to clear them. We were shown, how to do it. It was a difficult task, but obviously had to be done. But one of the associated problems there was that the Germans had attached booby traps in the form of box mines. These are small wooden mines, which were very temperamental, because being wood, they were subject to temperature changes in wood and everything. And, of course, they used to lay those all over the place. And you had to be very careful that they weren't anywhere connected to the main mine. So you had to forage underneath the mine, you had to forage on top, and when you took the fuse out of the main mine, you had to be sure it wasn't tethered to yet another wire.
Were any of your comrades casualties?
Yes, one chap was blinded by a box mine.
Did you see that happen?
Well, I just saw a puff of smoke and that from there, because stretcher bearers came out, took him away.
What happened next?
Well, of course, we consolidated the area, and then on about the 26th of July, because during this time, by the way, we were still clearing beaches, we actually went out to man the docks, because the Mulberry Harbour had sustained severe damage in a storm. So we had to go out to the freighters about 2 or 3 miles offshore in ducks, load up ammunition and come back again. There was one, myself and an RAFC driver for the duck. And we had to go alongside these ships, sort of tether ourselves somehow or other to the ship. And then they used to drop these huge great nets of 25 pounds of ammunition. The duck could carry about 3 tons. On one occasion we had to lift a body from the sea. A Norwegian sailor.
So you were doing like docker's work?
We were indeed. We had to. And then on about the 25th, 26th, we were marshalled together. Montgomery had given a directive that the beach group situation was to close down, and that because of the casualties up front were so considerable, they had to break the battalion up and send platoons here, there and everywhere. We went to, on the 26th of July, we landed at a place just outside Bayeux to join the Somerset Light Infantry, which was rather odd actually, because almost at once when we got there, we were posted from there to the 4th Wilth Battalion, who had just about lost more than half of its effective strength in an attack on Hill 112.
The 4th Battalion of the Wiltshires?
Mm. 43rd Infantry Division.
So you didn't stay in the Somersets very long?
A couple of days, if that. And so we, mind you, it was all the same division, of course. They were a 130 brigade, and I think we were 129 brigade. The actual fact, I've got books here written by the brigade commander then, General SM, as he was then, who was commander of the 130 brigade. He's written an autobiography of the whole divisional history vis-a-vis during the Normandy campaign.
What was morale like in the 4th Wiltshires when you joined it as a reinforcement?
I would say it was quiet. It wasn't jubilant or anything, because they, remember, they'd had a very somber time during the previous action, Hill 112, Canton somewhere. In that area, they'd been, as actual fact, one of the, Wheeler, Arthur Wheeler, the BBC commentator, gave a background, historical background to that particular attack, in which he said it was absolutely blunderous, to say the least. The Wiltshires were just simply thrown in, you know, without regard to the fact that there were prepared defences. So we sustained very heavy casualties.
Do you remember which company you went into with them?
Yes, B Company.
And how soon did you go into action with them?
Almost at once afterwards. I mean, we arrived one day, and the second day we were pushing forward. Of course, I say pushing forward is perhaps an understatement, because in fact the country is referred to as Bocage country, and every hedge was a problem, or every orchard was a problem.
Any incidents you can remember from that?
Well, there were so many, Conrad, there were so many. I mean, shell fire, the enemy shell fire was quite concerted. Then, of course, eventually, as the book will tell you, there are two books, called one called The Fighting Wyverns. Incidentally, the Germans called us the Yellow Devils, because we were a match for them, even against their most elite division. And they didn't like us at all. In fact, Hitler gave an order to annihilate 43rd, which is true. They found paperwork on an officer. So, anyway, during that, I suppose the highlight of my experiences was at Mount Pecon, which was the highest feature in Normandy, which our battalion had to assault and take.